This is tape three, side one of the October 10th, 2005 interview with Professor Joe Elder.
So we were now rolling in the sense that we had a pattern. We realized we had to have a faculty member over there all the time. That year was not all that successful, but we were going in the right direction. We had a Telugu campus that time.
Oh.
And one of my projects when I was there on my research league was to go to Hyderabad because Wisconsin had decided to teach Telugu as one of the non-Hindi languages.
Huh.
And so I found faculty at Osmani University, and there was a professor, B.H. Krishnamurti, who was a linguist and did Telugu. So we kind of linked up there. And between some of us overseas and some of us in Wisconsin, we were able to do the recruiting and the advertising and all the rest. Why not follow up on the year of our program? Because that became increasingly significant
sure.
over the years. Finding a faculty member who could take time out and recruiting students was a pretty complicated kind of venture. Almost none of my colleagues, including myself, wanted to be the faculty member over there because you're not going to get anything done seriously. I was able to get my research done, but only after the students cleared out. And I worked like a beaver from about March until August to get a year's research done so that I could say I'd accomplished more or less what I wanted.
Faculty didn't want to do it because it was babysitting?
Babysitting, and they couldn't do research. They're answering mail and taking people to the hospital and, you know, stool samples, all the kind of stuff that comes with that.
Uh-huh.
So none of my faculty members wanted to do that. And if I'd have known it was going to be that much babysitting, I would have been keen to do it myself. I believed in study abroad, but for somebody else. But we were lucky to find people. The first one was an ex-missionary named Bob Holmes. And so Bob came on, and he was the overseas faculty member for a number of years. He had a PhD, but it wasn't his real interest was not in any kind of research. He subsequently went on to become the head of the Fulbright program, which, having shown that you could administer an undergraduate program, you could administer a major program. Then we found faculty from Berkeley, we found faculty from Rhode Island, we found faculty from Wesleyan College. And some were better and some were worse, and one was slightly fraudulent, one took money that wasn't his. And it was okay until 1971, okay. Bangladesh War breaks out. The U.S. Takes a hostile position to India.
Mm-hmm.
India is aware that the CIA is all over, the feeling is the CIA is all over the place, and that India is being played with by the United States and the Soviet Union and everybody else. So in 72, I guess it was, the summer of 72, they announced essentially that they were giving no visas for students until they completely revamped the visa process.
Huh.
So we lost one of our classes. We selected the students. They were taking language training in this summer in Chicago. We had a letter from the government saying that our program had been approved for a number of years. We watched the Fulbright go down. We watched the Peace Corps get expelled. We watched all this other stuff go. We held on to that letter. And then early in August of 72, we got the message, that letter means nothing. Your Wisconsin students are not going to go to India until we come up with a new regulation. And that was one of a few heartbreaking moments I've had, because these students have worked all summer on Hindi or Telugu, cramming, getting ready, and now the summer was in a sense wasted. So the program shut down. In November, the new guidelines came out, and among other things, they said you could not have an American director. The students had to be enrolled in regularly given Indian courses. You weren't going to superimpose something, come in with, and then something else, I think, about the way money was processed. Anyway, we took one look at that and said, we can't keep the program going as it was. We can't send faculty members over there. It has to be an Indian director. The only programs I knew of that had Indian directors had very, very bad luck. Worcester College in Ohio had hired an Indian director. And the pressure on him from his family was just overwhelming. And the money was grossly misspent. Ended up building a house and doing all kinds of things. It was a disgrace, a huge embarrassment on everybody. And we didn't know anybody that could handle American students who was, you know, in a position to do it. And here's where Joan Raduca comes in. You want to sort of reverse the play.
Okay.
Joan had been on the program the year before. And she and John had sort of become, John Grace had become a couple. John had been there for sort of representing a faculty member from Wesleyan. But he knew the Wisconsin program. And so they were, we were in touch with each other watching the program collapse. John was willing to go back to India and take care of the furniture and books and odds and ends of things. So we paid him to go and just put things in order so that the program that we thought was going to be in place wasn't in place. And then he came back, and then came the bad news that it looked as though we had to shut down the program because we couldn't send faculty members. And John and Joan came up with this idea, well, why don't we have graduate students go and be the monitors of the program rather than directors of the program. Now, in the Indian context, a monitor is a student among students who's left to keep the class quiet while the teacher's out of the room. So in this case, it would be a student observing other students. So it wouldn't be a director, therefore we wouldn't be in violation of the Indian regulations. It would be somebody who would be in the employ of the University of Wisconsin and who would know American standards. And furthermore, since they would be low-cost employees, we could have a graduate student on each of the campuses where we had students. So instead of having the problems go to the deli where the person was and then maybe he'd come down, you'd have on-the-spot grad student, like a project assistant or a TA.
Huh.
So we took that into the dean, and he looked at us like we were both, all three of us were high on marijuana. He couldn't believe that we were serious. Look, we wouldn't send students to Florence with a graduate student. Right? All the stuff they can handle, and law cases, and somebody gets hurt, or somebody dies. But this was Mulvihill, who was dean at that time. But somehow, he bought into the idea, because I think he saw Joan and John and saw them as responsible. Sure, they were graduate students, but they were, you know, the Peace Corps at that time had directors who were 23 years old and stuff. Mm-hmm. The notion of you don't have to, you know, be in your 50s before you direct this. So he finally said, okay, I will give permission for this to be done, but on condition that if and when things go wrong, Joe, you drop everything here and get out there, because we are liable up to our ears if something happens. And parents are told, well, yeah, we had two graduate students. So that was the arrangement that we left. And John and Joan were appointed student monitors, and therefore they had to get student visas. They weren't directors, so we weren't in violation of the Indian regulations. And we were able to open up the program after a one-year hiatus.
That would be in 73.
71, 70, 72, 73 was the year we lost.
Right.
And then 73, 74, it opened again. And then, to make a long story short, that was the model that made it possible to open it up on a series of campuses.
Ah.
So over the years, we've had graduate student monitors on the Telugu campus, the Hindi campus, the Tamil campus. And these would be short-term. They maybe go out for 1 or 2 years. Most of them were incredibly diligent. This was the first serious job. They had budgets, responsibility. I think we can say probably we got better service out of graduate students than we did out of the faculty couples who often had kids and wanted to go to school or vacation and this sort of thing. And for the student monitors, this was their life.
And is this the model that's in place to
this day? This has been the model up until literally last year.
Oh.
And over the years, we've had probably 20 or 25 monitors in different locations. But John and Joan were the first, and they proved that it could be done. We ended it this last year. We had the last student monitor last year because the rules are still the same, but now we found Indian faculty who are thoroughly familiar with the U.S. system. They have their degrees in the U.S. They have PhDs in the U.S. And so they know what they're doing. So what we couldn't do back in 72, we now can do, and it's a new scheme, but the graduate student monitor entity was what held the whole thing together all these years.
How interesting. It's just it's just very impressive.
Mm-hmm.
that and you were able to pull it off.
Just as the Peace Corps found that you don't have to be all that old to administer a program. Well, these were usually selected from the students who'd been there before, so this was like picking the best of the crop. And it was, and we often have three or four people apply who want to be the monitor 2 or 3 years down the track. So we had this constant stuff in there, and it was the feather in the cap to be selected as the one that was going to go back and be the big brother, big sister for the next batch of students who were over there.
Joe, would you say that your involvement with this program of foreign exchange of students studying in India mm-hmm. has been closest to your heart of your work here on campus?
It wouldn't be very wrong to say that, I guess. I certainly have put in a huge amount of time with very little sense of regret.
Uh-huh.
You never know when something's going to go wrong. You're always frustrated that students don't do as well as they'd like to do. You sometimes groan that they have genitals and stuff like that. I mean, you wish they had never heard of marijuana. I mean, they do really stupid things on it. But through the whole mess, there have been some absolutely wonderful, very bright students. And now they're all over the place. The one we point to with greatest pride is Diana Eck. Diana Eck has been a professor of Sanskrit in Harvard for a bunch of years. And she has a worldwide reputation. She's in great demand as a lecturer and so on. And she went as a junior from, I think it was Smith College. And the story there is kind of interesting because the students, we went through the period where students didn't want to do anything if the faculty said so, including fill out forms and stuff. And I think this is correct, that the year she was selected in the program, we made a clerical error and we missed instructing her to go to Boston to be interviewed by me. And so we got down to the end line, and here were all the people I'd met, and these were approved and these weren't. And here was this one person that we just failed to send the letter to. And we had no good reason to turn her down. And so we let her in without ever being interviewed. Later on, she said if she got a letter saying, go to Boston and meet a Wisconsin faculty member to see if he thinks you're the right person to go to India, I just said, forget it. I'm not going to go to Boston to meet this guy I never met. So anyway, she came on. She was good, but didn't look brilliant particularly. Did a fascinating fieldwork project with all the wrong assumptions that I had when I was out there. You know, Hindus can't do this kind of thing. She talked to, I think, five professionals on the thesis. How could you be an engineer, a nuclear physicist, a physician, and a leading judge, and still be a Hindu with this notion of reincarnation and life after life after life and stuff? Well, she learned the same thing I did. There's no problem. It all can be fitted in perfectly well. And her conclusion was that they can be just as modern in terms of the way they look at technology and commitment to democratic principles and the rights of humans and all the rest. And Hinduism is just another kind of shade of color in terms of how they interpret it. But it doesn't block them, or they don't feel like they must stop being Hindus to be engineers any more than the person who doesn't have to stop being a Christian or a Jew in order to be a nuclear physicist or an astronomer or something like that. So a basic, simple insight when you stop and think of it, but it has to be each one of us has to find this out for herself. And then she went on to be, she's brilliant, I mean she is, to write the definitive book on the city of Benares.
Really?
Yeah, it's a huge thing, and it's been a bestseller. If anyone wants to know about Benares, it's Diana Eck's book on Benares. She called me at one point, because the publishers wanted to spell Benares, B-E-N-A-R-E-S, which is the way the British did it. And she was fighting against them, saying she wanted to be spelled the way it's spelled in India, which is B-A-N-A-R-A-S, which is the way it's spelled in Hindi. And I said, Diana, you're absolutely right. Just don't give in, because if it's B-E-N-A-R-E-S, everybody will assume that this is a foreign, a British profile. You're misspelling it the way the British misspelled it, and it's got to start with the wrong foot. Well, I'm not sure if I was critical in there, but it came out Benares, B-A-N-A-R-E-S.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think anybody in the world who claimed it is the definitive book. She went back again and again and again and just got all the stuff about the pilgrimages all right. Well, I can probably name...
Yeah, name some of the other...
Okay, Susan Wadley. Susan Wadley went on the program the year after, the year Henry, in 62, no, 63, the year I missed.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't meet her on the program. She's now dean in Syracuse. She's been head of the anthropology department. She's published a storm of stuff on this and has trained a whole battery of people who sort of have gone through the Susan Wadley program.
Huh.
There are two more people who've been teaching in Harvard. Rich Wolf has been doing ethnomusicology. I'm trying to remember the name of his wife right now. She's been the Hindi teacher there. Anyway, they're up and around all over the place. Because if you get somebody bright and into the language and then start off on a career, they can very often just build on it and go as far as they want. And that's a lot of fun, too. We had this South Asia conference this last weekend, and it was almost like feeding Mr. Chips, with person after person coming up. One guy, Rich Wolf, said, "You really got to see my kid." And he found me in the dining hall. He brings his kid in and said, "Show him his kid. This is Oliver."
That has to be of enormous satisfaction to you.
It's all the kind of feeling that you think you get in a small college. That you know them so well.
Yes.
And not only by name, but you knew them as undergraduates, and they worked with you as graduate students and so on. And the fact that they're all over the place means that the bond is a very personal one. It's not quite so much an institutional one as it was one-on-one.
Joe, I want to ask you about the story that Henry Hart told me.
Yeah.
About some student over there who'd been arrested for possession of marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
And you went over there, or you were there, I've kind of forgotten,
mm-hmm.
he said. And it was sort of a misunderstanding and somewhat of entrapment. But Henry Hart said that you advocated for the student up to the point of saying that if he got kicked out of the program, you were going to leave the program.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
I can. Henry exaggerated a little bit, but the principle is there. Yes, one of the students went to Kathmandu, found that you could buy marijuana relatively inexpensively in Kathmandu and come back and sell it for quite a lot in India. And he was trying to get money because he had a girlfriend, I think, in Israel or something like that. Mm. So he came back with a couple of kilos of marijuana, walked straight into an entrapment situation. There was a guy there who was sort of approaching people from Nepal as though he were a bootlegger who was interested in getting marijuana. So Michael was thrilled to find somebody who was about to buy it. And he got in the car and went to the police station. There he was. Marijuana, he said he had it was his. And the story that we got was they stripped all his clothes off to make sure he wasn't hiding anymore, and he spent a very cold, miserable, scary night in a jail in Delhi. And then the faculty member was contacted, he was out there, who then informed us that the student had been arrested and he was guilty all the way, and would be given a trial and could very likely be jailed for 6 months, or kicked out of the country one way or the other. Well, my position was, again, how could they be so stupid? He was the youngest of the team, and so one could sort of forgive him a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously a lot of people were getting away with it, so he just happened to walk into the wrong person at the wrong time. Now, the issue that came up was, does he get kicked out of the program? And at that point, I think there was even a rule that if a student were discovered to be involved in drugs, they were kicked out of school. Something a little bizarre, because my contention was that if you break the laws, you break the laws, but it doesn't get you kicked out of school. So in the back and forth, I remember sending something, a cable, something like, "Let the police punish him, but let's continue to educate him." That was sort of my philosophy. And at this point, one of the deans here said, "But if he's found guilty of a drug offense, then we have to kick him out of school." So I was trapped here with this notion. So I'm trying to recall how. Yeah, okay. Now I remember how we did it. So we technically disconnected him from Hyderabad, where he'd been. Arranged to have him take all directed study for the second semester, as though he was on campus here. He went to Benares, finished the year there, did stuff that he could get credit, not so much as being on the Wisconsin program as being a student enrolled in the University of Wisconsin.
I
now,
see.
The dean was really really unhappy at this, because he'd been aware that I've been dragging my feet all the way through this. And to a certain extent, this was, you know, we said he's off the program, we've taken care of that. What we didn't say is we've re-enrolled him as a student here. So he was able to finish his 4 years of college without a particular break. And since then, he's just done fine.
Uh-huh.
I don't recall ever having said that if he gets kicked out, I will quit. I don't think I would say that.
Uh-huh.
I would express as much resentment as I could, but it seemed to me it was pretty important for me to stay where I could be active. And I think once I discovered that there was this way in which we could legally kick him out of the program but reinstall him, and there's another faculty colleague who was working with me on this, Professor Dan Matson, and we were both in the same corner and said, okay, stupid kid, should be punished, but let's not wreck the year for him. And I still have the telegram that came after the trial. He was found guilty. He was eligible for 6 months in prison. And then we had written some letters saying, you know, it's a stupid kid and he should be punished. And I think he's scared. But please don't interfere. I mean, he's there to study. And if it's any way possible for him to continue studying, we in the university would be extremely grateful for that. And so whether that letter was or wasn't a critical factor, I don't know. We sent it to the faculty member and then showed it to the judge and so on. So this letter was something like, I still have his name, completely, totally free, signed the student's name.
Oh, really?
After the trial.
Yeah. After.
So he didn't have to serve any prison time, and then he was able to take the credit as a, not a program student, but as a Wisconsin student.
I think the point that Henry Hart was trying to make was that you really advocated for your students who were
right.
over there.
Right.
Really to ensure the success of the program.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I wanted to get.
Yeah, well that's unambiguous. Yeah. Okay, well, is that up?
Yes, it's on.
Over the years, we expanded the program with, you know, getting more and more students and adding more languages. So for a lot of the time, we had a Hindi campus in Benares, we had a Telugu campus in Hyderabad, or Voltaire. We moved at various places depending where students got the best language training. And then a Tamil campus in Madurai. And then in the 1980s, we opened up a campus in Kathmandu and had a program in Nepal.
Oh, you did?
Where students have studied either Tibetan or Nepali.
Huh.
And that was a whole other wing. It was sort of John Hitchcock, the anthropologist who was here, was a Nepali specialist, and he'd done an experimental semester in India where he went with a group of students back in 74. But the more we thought about it, the more we thought, well, heavens, Nepal is just a wonderful place. We have a Buddhist studies program, there are lots of Buddhists in Nepal. So John got the program going officially in 1980, and then he retired in 82. And by then, since we had the program going and the model of India worked very well, I became the faculty coordinator for the Nepal program, you know, which was the reason I spent, I think, more New Year's in Kathmandu than any other place in the world. Because every year what I do is, as soon as my first semester exams are turned in, I get on a plane and head out for the other side of the world to check up on the students whom I've met the summer before. Often I help select them, and then I met the summer before they were doing the
language. So you go out every year?
That's right, yeah. And spend essentially between first and second semester touching base with the students. That is truly rewarding, because you see the students when they come in, barely not knowing the language at all, and you work with them during the summer for 8 or 10 weeks, orienting them and watching them get the feel of Telugu or Tamil or Nepali or whatever. And then by the time you get there, most of them are able to negotiate fairly well in the language, and most of them are into their fieldwork projects. And the creativity of these characters, nobody wants to do the same thing anybody else did. And so they're looking for something offbeat, something that's different, something that's extremely hard. And it's just, it's the maraschino cherry on the dessert every year to go over there to see what they're doing. And they messed up and they got into trouble. And, you know, we have faculty that aren't teaching and we have all that kind of stuff, and uh-huh. budgets and the nonsense that comes with administering something. But the fun of just seeing where the students are and recognizing they still have 4 or 5 months to go before they're done, and then they're back in the States, and their careers will forever be in a somewhat different trajectory because of what they did. It's more reward than one ever deserves, I think.
Is the program in Kathmandu still in effect?
We closed it this year.
Oh, you did?
A couple of months ago. But I was there last winter, and the students were doing well. We had two students the year before, three last year. But we just couldn't keep the place up. We have facilities, cooks, language teachers. We were running in the hole $50,000 a year, 2 years in a row. You can't keep a program like that going. So it's very sad, we closed it down. We had a 25th anniversary for the Nepal program, the weekend of the 4th of July here in Madison.
Uh-huh.
We brought some of the Nepalis here.
Oh, you did?
And that was really fun, with sitting around the circle and having each person tell some anecdote about when I was there in 92, 93, or when I was there in 96, 97, when I was there in 89, 90. Just great goodwill, and sorry that we've had to shut it down, because it's not secure.
So it wasn't the political turmoil over there that shut it down?
Indirectly it was, because people didn't, parents didn't want their young people to go to an area the State Department kept issuing the traveler's advisories. What you do when a country is threatened is difficult, and as countries have become more difficult, the Office of International Studies programs have adopted different guidelines. It used to be that if there were a traveler's warning as opposed to traveler's advisory, then you'd shut down. But we went through one where that happened, and then we regretted doing it. The government of the U.S. government in the summer of 2002, I guess it was, looked as though India and Pakistan might be going to do a nuclear war.
Uh-huh.
And so they issued a traveler's warning. And we closed a summer program we have in Kerala. The students were here and went through orientation. Whereas sitting there, I knew that there was no threat of a nuclear war. But our principle was, if it's a warning, we cancel it. So we lost 7 or 8 people who were all set to go. Since then, as the warnings began to get tougher and tougher in Nepal, we said, let's not automatically assume that they're making the right judgment. We'll use as much good evidence as we can. We'll talk to the staff there, we'll talk to specialists, we have somebody in the Brookings Institute and so on, and get multiple readings on whether this is really serious. And so we kept the program in Nepal going past a whole series of traveler's warnings with no danger.
Uh-huh.
But then last fall, the Peace Corps left. And
oh, it did?
Yeah,
oh.
Under a sense of threat, shut down. And then it was mostly just the budget thing that we would have loved to continue. The staff said we're happy to keep doing it. There will always be 2 or 3 students willing to go, but you just can't run it at that kind of a loss. So we packed up the library and sent the library to Benares with all the books tagged, so that if and when the day comes we go back to Kathmandu, we can identify the library and take it back to that parent. Because after 20 years you have a pretty good, highly specialized library on Nepal and Tibetan Buddhism and anthropology of the area and the rest.
Are you going to continue with this program yourself for a number of years yet?
I'm still active, I plan to do so, yeah, right.
Uh-huh.
I'm built into, I get 1 month's salary for this from the Office of International Studies and Programs.
Oh, you do?
So it's not entirely voluntary, but it's, I can do it without getting paid. Oh.
Well, you can restrict access to this tape, so nobody right. will hear that.
And for years I did it without being paid.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I just was running it, and somewhere along the line, one of the deans said, how come you have a faculty member traveling over there and spending all this time, and you don't put him on salary somehow? And my response was, well, we're trying to keep the cost down as low as you can, and you toss it on 1 month faculty salary, and it means, a few $100 worth of it. But they have become much more professional over the years. When we started the program, I think we may even have been the very first study abroad program going, and you saw how informal and
yes.
from the hip it was when it started. Oh, I think we have 5 people over there. And then the French program or the German program. So sometime, probably in the late 1980s, they were regularizing this.
Uh-huh.
And they said, no, you should be paid for what you're doing. And I didn't kick and scream, so it's all year long, but then it's concentrated during the winter break when I'm over there working all the time on it. And then in the summer, the business of working on the orientation and having the students on the campus doing language training and being oriented.
Do you see student interest in South Asia, in India and Nepal increasing or holding steady?
It's always there, yeah. What's happened has been there are many more study in India programs than there were. It used to be, when we were first going, that we the student would write, I wanted to study someplace besides Europe, and yours was the only program I could find. Well, now we have 60 programs here in Africa and East Asia and Southeast Asia and so on. So we're not the only program in the block. We're still, without any doubt, the most rigorous program. We're the only one that lasts a year. We're the only one that requires intensive language training during the summer. And so I think the quality of the experience is a whole jump higher than any of the others who will have a semester, usually, and then you learn sort of emergency language while you're there, count to 10, and where's the washroom and stuff, but not as...
This is side two of tape three of the oral history interview with Professor Joe Elder, October 11th, 2005.
When we were wrapping up the talk yesterday, I was just about to say something about the way in which the college year in India was funded. Since traveling to India is so expensive compared to traveling anywhere else, built into the program was the problem of how do you offer something which anybody can go on without being fairly rich. Fortunately for us, and actually fortunately for the study of India, the U.S. and India had gotten into a financial arrangement in the 1950s and 1960s, which worked out to our advantage. In the 1950s and 1960s, India did not have enough wheat, and so it began to buy wheat from the Soviet Union and Australia and the United States. The arrangement was made with India that any U.S. wheat that was sold would be paid for in rupees and paid essentially to the U.S. Embassy in India. Hmm. So the money wouldn't flow out of India and lead to all sorts of deficits.
Oh.
So what happened was millions and millions and eventually billions of dollars worth of credit in rupees built up in the U.S. Embassy in Delhi, which could only be spent in India by projects approved by the U.S. Embassy. So when the Peace Corps was there, the embassy paid for the in-country costs with these rupees that they had. The embassy paid for the Fulbright program and also helped pay for various parts of the sort of centers that we were having. And with the money there, you could apply with an academic program. And if you were approved, then you could receive rupees waiting for you in India to use for your project. Well, once that came through, and I think that began probably in the late 1960s, first of all, it was through the State Department, and then it was through the Office of Education. We'd go in every year with our hand open. There was a form we had to fill out, and a request, and the budget, and how much was coming from Wisconsin, and how much was tuition, and so on. And you could never say that this was paying a huge portion of it, but it could supplement it. So for many years, we were able to get rupee supplementary funding, which we would be in competition with other year abroad programs and Fulbright programs and travel programs for teachers and stuff. We almost never got all we asked for, but we got, you know, enough, $50,000, $35,000, $70,000 each year, which helped keep the cost down for the students on the program. Well, these were called Public Law 480 rupees. Under the particular provision that the U.S. and India had. And under one of the American ambassadors, half that loan was forgiven. I think it was, the total was something like $5 billion, which were sitting in rupees. And one of the ambassadors simply said, we'll cut it in half. But there still was plenty of money for us. And then in the late 1980s, the whole thing was terminated. The what was left was essentially canceled. And so there went that source of revenue, which was very nice. It was also sort of peculiar because the money was sitting in the Delhi embassy.
Yes.
And so we'd have these graduate students going out to pick up the funds. And when you pick up, let's say they'd be picking up $50,000 worth of rupees. Okay, you multiply that by, let's say, 30, which is how many rupees. You're up to something like 150,000 rupees, which some graduate student is picking up in a duffel bag and carrying out of the embassy and feeling that there must be crooks around who are going to plug her or him over the head and there it will all go. It was not high-level banking at all.
But Joe, did the ambassador make the decision as to where the money was allocated?
It went typically to the cultural affairs officer. The people who handle things like the Fulbright program.
Huh.
The ambassador presumably knew about it, but he had much more important things the cultural affairs officer had to approve it, and then there was a screening committee of people in the Office of Education who would pass it on. So there were several steps that you went through, but ultimately it would be, you get a notification that this much, these many rupees were waiting for you, and then you had to indicate who was going to come by and pick it up, approximately what date.
But it wasn't a decision of the State Department, it was a decision of the embassy.
The Office of Education, the cultural affairs officer, who is an officer of the embassy, but his main task is cultural relations. He would be the one over the Fulbright libraries, huh. And he'd be the one to sit with the Fulbright programs. He was in that dimension rather than the political end or the economic end.
So that person was a very important person.
That
too.
Was, right. And occasionally it was actually a faculty member. For a while, the cultural affairs officer would be a professor from Texas or someplace who was there and serving as a State Department employee, but also doing his or her own research. Or he would be some kind of civil servant who worked his or her way up the board. Huh. But it was an interesting kind of relationship, and it was reassuring to get that money, because it kept the prices down. And also it meant that, in principle, we were always being approved by the Indian government as well, because none of these projects could be funded if the Indian government rejected it. So we had that sort of protection there. And then the back protection was that the student visas had to be issued by the government of India. So that all the way along the line, if the government of India had not wanted this to happen, there were two spigots that they could have turned to end it. Well, the rupees dried up about 1986 or something, and I could immediately see the price going up, probably $2,000 or $3,000 per student tuition. Uh-huh. And every time you do that, you realize you're losing the less advantaged students off the bottom end of it. But we were told that we could be competitive for dollar funding. We just would have much tougher competition. So long as it was rupees in India, we were competing only with programs that were in India.
Right.
And if we were competing with the regular dollars, it could be any kind of program anywhere. But we've been pretty consistently successful. There's, under the Fulbright-Hays program, there is a group study abroad project, and it can go to various countries. And we've sent our application in there, and almost every year we've been funded. We keep trying to figure out some way to look like we're newer and doing something fresh and different, but the same crowd in Washington sort of now know that we're there. As the years have passed, there were initially a number of other college programs that were competing with us. There was one, the Associated Colleges of Midwest would go in for a grant and various other places. So we weren't the only show in town. As the years have progressed, they've, in a sense, shortened their programs. It's one semester, less language, and so on. And so at the moment, I think we're the only undergraduate program that's funded under group study abroad, because it is a year and because we do insist on 2 years of language in the process. So at the moment, we're, I think, in a fairly good position. We're getting about $50,000 a year now, but that comes to Bascom Hill. That doesn't go to the embassy, and it gets handled through much more normal banking processes, and people going into the graduate students going into the embassy with an empty bag and coming out with a full bag and hoping
you don't have any bag men and women going into Bascom Hall.
That is now funded through normal sources. So that's helped keep the price down, but it still is hard, because you will see students who will apply. There is limited financial aid. If they're already on financial aid here, the financial aid office will try to increase it so that the gap they have to pay doesn't change whether they're here or they're over in India. But almost every year we see some students who just couldn't put the package together. And that's hard. You know, you hate to have a program that keeps people out because they can't afford it. But anyway, that's the financial side. Uh-huh. And now it is all handled under the Office of International Studies and Programs. So of the student fees that come in, we pay about $1,000 per student to the office here, which helps support the staff and the deans, which is important, and becomes part of the whole regularized 60 or so study abroad programs they have. Huh. And then under that arrangement, they provide all sorts of banking services and the kind of employment contracts that you happen to have, and, you know, the administrative things that something like this requires. So there we
quite
are.
Quite an accomplishment.
Yeah, right.
It
and
really
almost
is.
Every year, the finances change. You know, 1 year be this way, and you couldn't do it that way, and so on. The year they went electronic, we lost the proposal entirely, because we had thought we'd file electronically, and we apparently didn't push the right button. And only in the spring, when we said, well, how did our grant application come along? They said, we never received it. And we went back, and here we had this thing which we thought we had sent, and they had never gotten. So that was a bad year. The next year, we sort of got tuned in and made sure that as with these electronic things, we did everything correctly and pushed the right buttons. So I think we can now repeat that. But it was the price of technological advancement was missing the year's funding.
A steep price.
That's right. Okay, when I arrived in Madison, this was the difference between what I was expected to do as a faculty member here and what I was expected to do as a faculty member in Oberlin College was quite different. In Oberlin College, the expectation was that at some point I would turn my dissertation into a book, but there was no great rush about that. And I would take part in conferences and occasionally present something. But the pitch was teaching well, you know, doing good seminar work, consulting, and so on, without any great emphasis on publication. It was an intensive teacher college. It was pretty clear after I got here that it was important that I start having something published, because I had nothing of significance appearing in print, and I'd been teaching 2 years. So I was very glad to start all over again. I was given the option of counting the 2 years toward tenure, and I was advised not to.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
that you can start from scratch. And I realized that with no publications at all to my credit, if I had knocked off 2 years, then I'd be up for tenure that much earlier. And that was not a smart idea. So the first summer I was here, I cranked out an article from some material I gathered while I was in the village. I started working on my dissertation to try to convert that into a book. And then a number of projects got going, all with a South Asia emphasis, in which I became involved, and from which the first series of publications came, not so much in sociology as they were in South Asian studies. Henry Hart had been able to get some money for the publication of a syllabus for a year's course on Indian civilization. And they needed somebody to be the chief editor of that. So I became the editor for that with a couple of graduate students. And we began to put together a series of altogether probably about 50 or 60 lectures on everything from the most ancient Vedas in India up to India's foreign policy. And the idea was to have specialists prepare lecture outlines, maybe 2.5 pages or something, so that even if I didn't know anything about Sanskrit drama, I could give a lecture on Sanskrit drama for a course that was well-rounded. Because more universities and colleges were trying to introduce India, and India is very, very complicated. And you might have somebody who was a political scientist or somebody who was a literature person, but if you need to teach a course that has everything in it, you need some kind of materials. So it was great fun working on that. I was in touch almost immediately with the cream of the new crop of American Indian specialists who were in Berkeley and Chicago and various places that were just getting going. And with a small editorial group, we selected the people to do these summaries. And then my job was to keep after the faculty until they showed up, and then edit them so they were in some sort of consistent fashion, get bibliographical references so that if you did give the lecture and somebody said, I'd like to do more of this, there would be some sort of required reading or recommended reading. It took us probably a year and a half or 2 years of pretty steady work to produce this. It was called the lectures in Indian civilization, which we first called it. It was to be almost free to anybody because it was all being funded by, again, the Office of Education money. Well, as we were preparing that, it was clear that there were several areas that there wasn't any good 25 or 30 page article on that topic. They'd be scattered around, or there'd be a long book or something that had been translated from French or something like that. So we began to pick chapters that should be written that would be kind of class bite size of quality, which could then accompany the lectures. So from the first lectures in Indian civilization came chapters in Indian civilization. And this involved going back to people and saying, look, there's no really good 30 to 40 page article, let's say, on the relationship between the Vedas and later Hindu texts. And somebody needed to do this. We found people who could do that. So we ended up with a volume called Lectures in Indian Civilization, and then volume one of chapters in Indian Civilization, and volume two in chapters in Indian Civilization. I wrote a handful of the lectures myself, and I wrote one of the chapters myself, but mostly this was other people.
Uh-huh.
But what I was doing, which was very good here, was a lot of stuff was coming out with my name attached to it. And it was stuff that had not been done by anybody, so it was kind of path-breaking. And I was learning a huge amount about India, because it wasn't Joe Elder, the sociologist, it was Joe Elder trying to figure out what was happening in, you know, the ancient Buddhist philosophy and what was happening as the Muslims arrived in India and what was happening when the British decided to introduce land taxes and all that kind of stuff.
So, again, this was quite fortuitous.
It was absolutely fortuitous, because it meant that my book was sitting there not being published, but this stuff was coming out, and it was reassuring to both departments that I was being productive. I wasn't just going out. I will never forget, I wasn't aware when my tenure decision was going to come up. It was much more relaxed in those days. I knew at some point there would be a tenure decision, and that I should publish stuff, but there was no kind of sense. The sociology department hadn't hired anybody for several years before I got here, so there was no big brother that I could talk to and say, how do you do this kind of thing? And the Department of Indian Studies had, you know, nobody there either who was doing it, so we were all just kind of making up the rules as we went along. I wasn't aware how closely I was being scrutinized by the senior faculty. I was going, you know, giving my lectures and meeting my students. And then one day, probably in February,
Year?
This would have been my first year there, I guess. 61, 62, yeah. A professor I knew in the department, we never exchanged anything. He sort of knocked on the door and came in the office, and I was intrigued that this guy I never talked to, who was pretty prominent, came in, and he just said, Joe, we've been talking about you. I thought, gulp, you know. And we're getting very good references on your teaching, and it's obvious the students are learning a lot. There's always students outside your office door. But I do want to make it clear that you have to publish. And whatever you do to publish would be very good, because we can't retain you if you don't publish. And then off he went. So that was sort of...
Well, that was pretty clear.
There we are, right? But no indication of what I should be publishing, just that I should be doing something. That was the very first year. The second year I was in India with the research grant and these students, so I was kind of out of the fray. But gathering material from which I would be able to publish stuff. But it takes a while to gather and then a while to come out afterwards. So I was aware that I had to be doing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But these other materials, the Civilization of India syllabus, the lectures and so on, were there coming out kind of as I was working on my own stuff. So when my tenure decision was made, and I wasn't aware it was going to be made.
Really?
Yeah.
They didn't tell you?
It was sort of in there somewhere. I never had letters saying you'll be... Now it's laid out in absolute pure... plain black and white, that at this point there'll be a decision made and so on. But I don't think I had any letters or anything that said that. It was still kind of a very informal campus at that time. Anyway, Russ Middleton was the chair, and apparently he tried to get in touch with me and couldn't, so he called my wife and said, we want Joe to know that he's been approved for tenure. We would like him to finish the book, but we feel there's enough there now so that we can promote him. And my wife, I think she said, is that good that he got tenure? It was a very different relationship to this whole thing, which now has been regularized and there's been litigation and all this other kind of stuff. So I was living in kind of a golden haze of, at some point you have to have something, but I wasn't clearly aware that there was an absolute deadline at which point I would be in
trouble. So what that professor said to you your first year did not produce anxiety on your part?
No, he just said I had to do something. But it wasn't, he didn't say, if within 2 years your book isn't out, you better start looking for a job. It was just very vague. And I was aware that publishing was important, but I had to do something. But, you know, with the research year in India, I did come back with a bunch of stuff that I was able to get some articles out. The book continued to be difficult, partly because it had been so wrong. After about 3 years, I began denying I'd written one of the chapters. It was so bad. And after about 6 or 7 years, I had really such erroneous conceptions of how the caste system worked and what Hinduism was, that it was embarrassing for me to admit that I had this many misimpressions when I created the first hypothesis. My hypothesis was, and it was based on Max Weber, that the whole fabric of Hindu value systems was such that you lived in the world of tradition, you did what your caste was supposed to do, and all your roles were expected, and there was a great deal of ritual involved, and sense of contamination with lower people, and so on. And so Max Weber had argued that one reason India never developed industrial capitalism independently was the values were such that they just were hostile to it. And that was a thesis that I was almost going to go out and check. It seemed kind of sensible to me. So I was predicting that where this gigantic factory had come in, it would survive because it was big, but there'd be constant problems with labor that would be unhappy, there'd be discontent, there'd be high labor turnover, there'd be tardyism, there'd be absenteeism. People would resent the fact that they had to work in a factory when they would rather be staying at home or working in the fields. And I'd worked out something like 15 or 16 indices of role conflict. These two systems, sort of Western rational bureaucracy, as opposed to traditional doing things as they like that. And it wasn't until I was sort of halfway into my time in the village that it occurred to me, I'm wrong. This is not coming out as I'm expecting. The factory's churning away. Absenteeism was practically nil. Tardiness was practically nil. Turnover was almost nothing. There was constant pressure by people to get more jobs in the factory. It wasn't the people who were leaving it. There were a couple of dramatic moments when I realized that I was seriously wrong. One of the questions I had on my questionnaire was, every Hindu is supposed to perform their dharma, which is your inherited task. How do you know what your dharma is? And that was presumably to be what the priest told you, or what your family told you, or something like that. Well, I was asking this question of the manager of the distillery, which is connected with the factory. And he said, I know when I perform my dharma, when all the mail that was in the inbox in the morning is in the outbox in the evening. I thought, no role conflict there. There's no problem at all. And then I talked to the local Brahmin, and I said, what did you think when this factory came in? Because you have low caste people and high caste people. And he said, well, I very much hope my son can get a job in the factory. Could you help me? And that wasn't supposed to happen because he was supposed to be opposed to this. So the longer I was there, the clearer it became that my major hypothesis was just way, way off the wall. Either the factory had become so Hinduized, if one can use that word, that it wasn't conflicting with people, or Hinduism was so flexible that it could just easily reinterpret whatever it was, and things would just go right on doing. But there was all this evidence that I was looking for wasn't there. So my dissertation was still sort of based on the half-baked idea, this is what I'm going out to discover, and it turned out not to be so. How do I explain it then? And I hadn't quite worked that all out. So to make a long story short, I've never published the book, the dissertation. It was getting more and more embarrassing. And now I'm very, very happy I didn't publish it, because there's been a whole lot of criticisms of the way Westerners have thought about India.
Yes.
This notion that they're sort of locked into perpetual stagnation because of religion and so on. And if my name had been attached to something, even if I could say, well, look, I was a 25-year-old graduate student, forgive me, it would still be around my neck. And so I'm very happy that book has never come out. Periodically, my wife says, why don't you sort of rewrite the whole thing? And maybe at some point I would, just to say how wrong I was. But I have never worked with a graduate student whose dissertation was as totally destroyed by the evidence as my own. And so anyway, the book became more and more problematic. There were a couple of chapters I pulled out and tried to do something with, but even then, it as a unit has never appeared in this collecting dust way at the bottom of my desk someplace or other. But I keep saying that probably that was the most important lesson, because since then, what I have written about how the caste system works and what it is a radical attack and critique of what almost everybody was saying when I was learning it from them. And that's been important. So I'm now seen as sort of the new wave of scholarship that came in and pointed out the discrepancies between the old approach, which was based largely on the Sanskrit text and the assumption that the texts say it, that's what people do. And you don't have to argue very far to figure out what the texts say. Often aren't done by the people, or are done only by the small elite at the top, and the rest of the people do pretty much other things.
I think that is a fascinating article that you should write.
Right.
Your personal epiphany,
right,
in the highest levels of scholarship.
Right.
Isn't it? I mean, yeah. Wouldn't people be interested in that?
It could probably be constructed that way. And when I present lectures on it, I will say, this is what happened to me. I mean, here I start out with these assumptions, and here's what just said, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong, until I finally said, you know, I was quite wrong on it. So.
But that had no impact on your getting tenure.
No, fortunately. the fact that, luckily, all this other stuff was coming in. It was voluminous, you know, the volume of lectures that thick with a glossary and dates and stuff. And then mm-hmm. these two chapters, which are, I say, still first rate. I think the articles are written by very, very bright people. And most of them are still very much up to the mark.
Mm-hmm.
So my title, my name was attached to these as the editor of all these kinds of things that I've helped. And then when I did bring data back from my year in Lucknow, there were a number of quite interesting articles I could get out quite quickly. Uh-huh. So it was there was no book, but there were these volumes, which I'd been the editor of, three of them, and then a series of small articles. And I think the department wanted to give me tenure, and they're looking for some sort of excuse to do it. So it was not a crisis. And then since then, I've continued to publish stuff as it comes along. But what I began to get into, which has been probably, to the extent I have a reputation as being a creative scholar, is the making of documentary films.
Yes, both Henry Hart and Joan Raduca said, be sure you ask him about the films.
Right.
So,
and as with almost everything else I talk about, it was coincidental, it was something I hadn't pictured happening. When we prepared the syllabus, for the lectures, we were trying to list documentary films that could be used, and it was appalling how little stuff there was, or how proprietary the people were who had them. There was a Sanskritist in the University of Chicago who was absolutely brilliant. He wrote several of the lectures on the Vedas and post-Vedas. He had filmed a Brahmanical sacrifice, a Vedic sacrifice, but he would not let anybody see it unless he was there. Feeling that it would be too easy to misinterpret. And so here was one authentic piece of documentary footage, which I was never able to see because I would have to go down to Chicago and all of that. Then there was stuff that tourist people had put out, but this was, you know, the Sun, Star, Soul, of the West kind of stuff, or quaint dancers. One series that an amateur professor of religion in Syracuse had done on home rituals, 10 minutes of this and 3 minutes of that and stuff. And one or two documentary films on village life, but very superficial. So it was clear that there was a gaping need for high-quality, scholarly documentary film. So in the lectures, we list whatever there were, but it was more and more manifest that this was a huge lacuna in materials. The break came with one of the students on the college year program. He wanted to do a documentary film instead of a fieldwork report. Huh. We had had one student a few years before who wanted to do a documentary film, and in my usual sort of, sure, let's try it, I said yes. And it had been a disaster. He took a camera out, he never got a good idea. He shot a little bit of footage around the Red Fort in Delhi, came back and just said, I can't do anything. And so there was 12 credits of zip that he got for all the tuition to pay. So when this second student said, I said, well, let me warn you, our first experience was not very good, but I'm game. If you want to do it, sure, there's no reason you couldn't do it. Well, it turned out that he produced a wonderful, simple, black and white documentary with almost no narrative on the city of Benares. He took his father's old wind-up Bolex camera with him, sat on the front of some of these shops with a blanket over his knees and the lens projecting through a hole in the blanket, just filming people as they went by. Now that doesn't sound like a great film, either to you or to me, I'm sure. And when he came back and said that's what he had, I said, you know, I don't want to be discouraging, but I don't think we have a film here. He had done enough of sort of 15 feet to one that we were going to produce, so that by trimming it, he got a sequence of the morning beginning with people going down to the Ganges River and bathing and collecting water, and then various things happen during the day, the cremation of bodies as they were carried down to the river. And then as the day ended, things sort of settled down, and a few people still out on the banks meditating. There was no soundtrack, it was black and white. He found a sarod player, which is sort of like it's a stringed instrument, to watch the film four or five times and then play accompaniment. So there was a musical accompaniment that went with this that matched the scenes. a little bit of fake sound when the wood cutters for the funeral pyre hit the axe against the wood. He had an axe and a tape recorder chopped away, so there was that kind of sync sound. And for the chanting, when you carry bodies to the bank of the Ganges or cremation, the chant is Ram, Nam Ram, Satya Ram, Nam, the name of God is truth, the name of God is truth. And so he got four or five of us to sit together in front of a tape recorder and chant Nam Ram, Satya, so that we would have that sound. Uh-huh. So it was sufficiently deceptive, so you had you didn't have the feeling this was all dubbed in. There was no real point to it, but you really got the feel of what life was like with people who were unaware they were being filmed doing the things that goes on all day. Well, he graduated.
Do you remember his name?
Yes, Michael Camerini.
Okay.
His dad was in the physics department and his mom was in the Scandinavian Studies program.
Okay.
And he had been a neighbor for a while in Madison.
Oh.
So I sort of known him as a neighbor kid. But I didn't realize how talented he was as a filmmaker. And this was his first film. He graduated, wanted to make more films. So he came around and said that he wanted to apply for films, but as a 21-year-old BA with one film to his credit, no one was going to give him any money. He would do all the work. He would prepare proposals. He would have me submit them as the producer, executive producer, whatever. And he would do whatever was necessary. So we cooked up a series of documentaries that would kind of fit in with the series, the lectures, and sent off. He scrutinized all sources of funds.